This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
5 days, 4 minutes of live radio, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond coming up. It's been a very bad week for media companies. We'll talk about that for a little while. Also, a quiz of sorts, a test, if you will, about the best way to get investors for your startup. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, it is the 7th day of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It has been a busy, busy week that we have had. So without a whole lot of messing around, we're going to dig right in. Lee Gallagher is with Fortune Magazine. She's at our studios in New York. Jolene Kent is at Fox Business. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
So let's do a couple of things real quick. First of all, Lee, give me your gut on the unemployment report this morning. 215,000 new jobs. Unemployment stays steady at 5.3%. What do you think?
It was good, you know, about what we expected. The big thing, though, is wage growth is still really not great. And so, but that, even that is sort of like exactly the same thing we've been saying. It's like Groundhog Day. But the real question, of course, is is this strong enough for the Fed to act if it chooses to act in September?
Well, hang on. We'll get to the Fed in a minute.
Okay.
It was you sounded almost bored there. Oh, yeah, it was fine.
Well, it's like, you know, in the way,
no,
it's good, no drama,
totally.
You know, but it's, you know, it's, I guess it's what we want in many ways.
So, Joe, talk to me about the wages part of this thing, right? Because that is what we have been told all along is what the Fed's waiting for. A little wage inflation, a little rising pressure there, and we're not seeing it.
Yeah, we're not. It was flat last month. It was up, what, 0.2% this time around. And so the wage growth really isn't there to project a little bit of confidence in maybe how consumers might react to rates rising. But overall, I would say no big red flag. Someone out there, I don't know who it was, said it might be strong enough to keep the September Fed hike alive, maybe.
All right. So let us segue now into an equally brief discussion of Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve. Smart money, Lee, or let's say conventional wisdom. I don't know how smart it is. Conventional wisdom is that September is when they're going to hike. I frankly think it's going to be later than that. What do you say?
Well, I kind of think it probably will be later, even though everybody does seem to you know, the alarm bells are signaling.
Yeah.
But, you know, they may want to get ahead of the curve, but and they want to preserve the right to raise it very, very gradually. So starting early does do that. But September is really like tomorrow.
Yeah, well, that's right. Joe,
yeah.
So what do you think about September? But also talk to me for a second about the importance of the second rise, right? The one that comes after whatever the first one is.
Yeah, it's probably even more important because it will be based off of all of the reaction of that first little hike. But I personally think it'll probably be December. September, it does feel like tomorrow, as Lee says. There's still slack in the labor market. If you look at labor force participation, still at, you know, three-decade lows, there is some skepticism there. December might be the Goldilocks time to actually do it.
Oh, good phrase. Good phrase. I like that. All right. Let us go to the conversation du soir last night, the debate, the GOP debate in Cleveland. Amazing ratings for that thing, by the way, like 24 million people, which is bananas. Lee, I want to talk about the way it went economy wise. It was an hour and like 6 or 7 minutes before they got to an economic question in that thing. And I want to posit for a minute that maybe the reason they didn't tackle it sooner, the Fox News anchors, was because they think the economy's in good shape. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, that's true. And then I think the most prominent discussion of business was actually around Donald Trump's
bankruptcy. His bankruptcy, I know, yeah.
But I also think it's significant that the two, you know, Carly Fiorina, conventional wisdom says she won the happy hour debate.
Yeah.
And then you have Trump. And these are both business people. The two people that people are talking about today are CEOs. And you know, this is a time when the economy is on everyone's minds. But it's true that it wasn't a huge part of last night, and that was a little befuddling.
Yeah, especially because, Joe, you know, the recent polling, all of them, Pew and Gallup and all this jazz, by like 75%, people say the economy is the biggest issue for them in this campaign.
Yeah, it is. But it seems like it's such a crowded Republican field that last night the audience seemed to really react to the fact that each of these candidates finally got some more serious questions and they actually right. could be stripped away from some of their talking points and stump speeches. But absolutely, you know, the voter is going to vote, so to speak, with their pocketbook. And I think that's probably why you see this Trump appeal, this successful business magnate who's speaking his mind, unbridled sort of enthusiasm for what he thinks.
Unbridled,
right or wrong.
Unbridled, she says very discreetly. All right, we got to go. Jolene Kent from Fox Business and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thank you both.
Thanks,
thank
Kai.
You.
All right, have a nice weekend. Wall Street today woulda, coulda, shoulda, but didn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Abercrombie & Fitch, the clothing retailer, said today it's going to stop doing what is known as on-call scheduling. We should be clear that Abercrombie is going to stop doing that because the Attorney General of the great state of New York had begun making some inquiries about the practice, shall we say. Workers don't much care for it, and as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, some companies could be having second thoughts about it, too.
When Russell Miller worked at Abercrombie, one of his days had to be an on-call day, so he wouldn't know if he'd have to show up to work until an hour in advance.
You had to block out that time period as if you would be working.
He says it was more than an inconvenience.
Having a second job couldn't work at a time when I was scheduled for an on-call shift. So if I was scheduled for an on-call shift and they didn't call me, absolutely that was real money lost and real time opportunity lost.
For other workers, on-call makes childcare and school difficult to manage as well. The practice isn't limited to retail.
Fast food work, airlines, beauty services, domestic services, childcare services.
Stephanie Luce teaches labor studies at the City University of New York. For employers, the idea is to save money by trimming hours.
Smaller studies seem to suggest this practice really picked up after the recession. However, in the last couple of years, there's been a real pushback.
Abercrombie says it's been considering for some time how to make worker schedules more predictable. It and Victoria's Secret are ending on-call scheduling. Susan Lambert is associate professor at the University of Chicago.
New technologies give us the ability to predict very well variations in demand.
Companies don't need to keep workers on hold. They can figure out pretty well whether they need to have someone show up for work far in advance of 2 hours before the shift starts. Lambert also says when companies use on-call workers who show up irregularly, those workers aren't always up to speed, and that creates hidden costs.
In terms of people walking out because they can't find the merchandise or can't get the help they need or having somebody who doesn't know where things are at.
So it may be, she says, that people are finding on-call scheduling is a headache for everyone. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We don't do a whole lot of specific sector analysis on this program, you know, transportation stocks or retail for that matter. But this has been an absolutely brutal week for media companies. Time Warner, Disney, Viacom, 21st Century Fox, all of them took a beating in the markets. Billions of dollars in investor value were vaporized as a result. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is here to explain what is going on. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Guy.
All right, so what gives? What happened to media this week?
Well, so it was pretty remarkable. Disney comes out with record profits and warns that maybe in the future ESPN and its other cable networks won't do as well.
Right.
And all of a sudden, everybody freaks out.
But this is not a surprise, right? This whole over-the-top thing and maybe ESPN someday, that's not something that we haven't talked about.
Exactly. I mean, cord cutters have been cutting cords for a long time. We've talked about that a lot on this show. But ESPN is sort of magical in the cable world. It's seemingly untouchable. Right. We all have to have our sports, right? And ESPN is part of the reason that we all pay way too much to have a lot of channels we don't watch. So when investors heard that ESPN was vulnerable, I think it made them realize just how vulnerable the rest of cable really was. I called up Professor Robert Thompson, who studies television at Syracuse University, and asked him what he made of the market reaction.
All right.
All of this was probably inevitable. The writing has been on the wall for a long time, but it's happening really quickly. You look at some of those cord-cutting numbers from last year to this year, and this is a trend that's at a gallop, it seems.
And here's the math on this one, right? The less, the fewer people are watching, the less advertisers are going to pay, and thus it's sort of this self-perpetuating, ever-increasing, decreasing concentric circle, right?
Yeah, bad story for cable. We have a lot of data showing this is happening. National television ad spending has lost hundreds of millions of dollars to digital by some estimates. Local TV ad spending is lost too. The television industry really is in the middle of figuring out what its new business model looks like.
You actually spent your week in the middle of the television industry, right? Out at the TCA's, the Television Critics Association meetings?
I was there. I was sitting in a dark ballroom all week watching trailer after trailer and hearing studio exec after studio exec tell me this is the golden age of television. There is so much good television out there in the middle of this. You know, what's going on with this industry? You know, I asked Professor Thompson about this.
It is fascinating that when the television industry was at its fat peak in the old oligopolistic days of three networks, the kind of shows we got were Talking Horses and Flying Nuns. Now we're in this period where nobody's quite sure where the business model is going to finally land. Yet at the same time, we get these shows that are better than most movies and better than a lot of novels.
And yet they're bringing back the Muppets, for crying out loud. Come on.
You know, I guess when you don't know exactly how you're going to make money, all of these networks, all of these TV makers are trying to make the best television they can to get us there.
Right. And just seeing what sticks on the wall. Marketplace's Adrian Hill covers entertainment for us. Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks, Guy.
On the face of it, a traffic ticket is a traffic ticket, right? But if you remember back to Ferguson, Missouri last year, one of the things that was going on there was that that city was raising a whole lot of money, a big part of its budget, through fines and fees from those tickets. And beyond Missouri, depending on where you are, if you get a ticket and you can't pay, you are especially unlucky if the city uses a private probation company to collect your debts. Marketplace's Gigi Duban explains why.
Tiffany Wilson lives in a small duplex in the town of Gurley, Alabama, population 798, 2 hours north of Birmingham. Wilson lives with her husband, Brad, a press operator at a local newspaper, and their two toddlers. This time last year, the family was homeless. Part of Wilson's money problems are in this thick binder she pulls out, full of receipts from her probation company.
Yes, and that's not even all of them. There's been a lot of receipts that got thrown away, but that's all I could find.
In 2011, police in nearby Scottsboro pulled Wilson over. She got one ticket for speeding and one for no proof of insurance. In a town next door, same thing. Two more tickets. Her total in fines, $1,016. Wilson didn't have that kind of money, so the city sent her to a private probation company called Judicial Correction Services. Wilson met with her probation officer every Friday.
She said, you have to figure out a way to come in with payment or anything, or you'll go back to court, and if you don't do it, the judge will put you in jail.
3 years, one income tax refund, and 1 week in jail later, she paid it off. But Wilson says it wasn't the fines that got her so much as the probation fees JCS charged, anywhere from $35 to $45 a month.
Like here, fees in arrears, $450, with only owing $103 for your fine, but I owed $450 in fees. That's wrong.
Sarah Zamperine is an attorney with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which sued the city of Clanton for using JCS. The lawsuit was settled when Clanton dropped its contract.
What we heard in Clanton was that often JCS employees would use the threat of jail and set more frequent appointments to try and give people every opportunity to bring as much money as they could. They wanted to extort as much money out of people as possible.
Asked for comment, the company issued a statement. Quote, JCS operates at the discretion of the court system with which we are contracted. We are not a decision maker as it relates to sentencing and establishing fines, end quote. Recently, several other municipalities have stopped using JCS, fearing similar lawsuits. One of them was Scottsboro. 10 years ago, JCS officials met with the Scottsboro City Council and offered to take probation off the city's hands. Rick Wheeler is the city's finance director.
Their pitch to us was that they were able to have the manpower that they could collect fines for us, and they would put people on a payment plan.
At the time, Scottsboro had only two court employees. JCS has 40 offices in Alabama alone. Its services wouldn't cost a thing. So how could the city refuse?
You couldn't. It was a good sales pitch, and they did. They've done a very good job for us.
City revenue went up under JCS. In 2005, Scottsboro collected $530,000 in fines. In 2014, it collected $879,000. JCS would send Scottsboro a check every month. But JCS paid itself first. If a person on probation paid, say, $50, the company took its monthly fee off the top, and only $5 went to the court. Tiffany Wilson and her husband are still digging themselves out of another JCS debt, her husband's more than $1,700 worth of traffic fines and monthly fees.
We're getting close, but it seems pretty impossible because it's hard to pay what they expect you to pay every time. And when them keep adding to it, it's like you're trying to fight a losing battle.
Wilson takes the kids out to a trampoline she and her husband found on Craigslist, a birthday present for their three-year-old.
Other way. Hi. Go to the trampoline. Come on.
She says last year they couldn't afford to get him a gift. This year is shaping up to be a little bit better. In Scottsboro, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, how to get investors to buy into your startup?
There's not really a lot that you can do besides just really wowing people, I think.
Well, there is one thing. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 46 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 17,373. The NASDAQ down 12 points, also 0.25%, finished at 5,043. The S&P 500 declined 5 points, almost 0.3%, 2,077. So for the 5 days gone by, it breaks down like this. The Dow off 1.8%, the NASDAQ down 1.7%, the S&P 500 give back 0.2%. Make it 6 straight weeks of losses for oil as the price of U.S. crude continues to drop down 26% in the last month and a half. 26% in a month and a half. Crazy. Chevron dipped 0.2%. ExxonMobil off 0.6% today. Groupon cut its sales outlook for the year and thus the coupon company clipped off 5%. Weaker demand for chocolate over in China soured Hershey's earnings. The chocolate maker melted more than 2.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The recently merged Kraft Heinz Company releases quarterly earnings. The movie classic Sunset Boulevard, starring Gloria Swanson, premiered in New York 65 years ago on August 10, 1950. And here is a reason to go outside and play. Monday is National S'mores Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a little bit more than 4.5 years since the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. The country went cold turkey on nuclear power after that meltdown. So it's of note that next week on the Japanese island of Kyushu, they're going to be flipping the switch back on, restarting a nuclear plant for the first time since. Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk has been following this story from here and from there. Here he is.
Japan's nuclear plants have put in redundancy since the disaster, like cooling water tanks and backup power. But until you fire the plant back up, you can't be sure the key plumbing works, say the pipes and gaskets that handle 200-degree water, says David Lockbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
There are things that you can't test until the plant gets up and running, kind of like a car that's been idled for a while or in a shop for a while. It's really when the car goes out on the road that certain things can be tested.
It's not just hardware. Safety culture has to restart right. Dale Klein is a former U.S. regulator and heads a reform panel at Tokyo Electric Power. He says pre-Fukushima, Japanese culture didn't allow much questioning, such as, is the tsunami wall high enough?
If the safety engineers would have questioned, well, how high should it be? What would you do if one comes in higher than that? It would have made things different.
Going forward, he says plants have to self-report errors and regulators have to be more assertive. If the process is bumpy, the Japanese public could question restarts at other plants. Stephen Kraft is with the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry group.
There's a list of about 20 that have applied. Once you've got one that's okay, it becomes a lot easier to know what to look for going forward.
What's at stake? Japanese proponents want nuclear to grow to 20% of its energy mix. It was over 30 before Fukushima. Globally, some 70 nuclear plants are now being built and would rather avoid bad news. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Being an entrepreneur can be brutal. Getting people to eventually buy whatever it is that you're making is hard enough. But before you can even get there, you have to convince investors to risk their money on your dreams. For that, you need, in roughly this order, a great idea, a talented team, and a really, really good pitch. But sometimes even all that is not quite enough, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Imagine yourself in a conference room considering a risky investment in farming technology. You're going to judge clips from two video pitches to decide who gets $1 million. Here's the first.
Currently, the fish egg market is worth $1 billion a year. To the existing market, Cryocyte offers eggs that produce healthy, meaty fish without the need for expensive environmental modulation equipment.
And here's the second, which is quite similar.
By providing eggs during a time of year that they simply cannot be produced currently, we enable a $300 million market segment that we are uniquely positioned to address.
Who do you risk $1 million on? Take a moment to decide. The clips came from a recent entrepreneurship study from Harvard, Wharton, and MIT's business schools. And actually, the pitches aren't just similar, they're identical.
Our goal is to become the Monsanto of the sea.
Same idea, same numbers, same slides. The only difference is the speaker's gender. Yet in the experiment, men and women preferred the male to the female. And in fact, of $50 billion in venture capital invested during 2011 to 2013, only 3% went to companies with female CEOs.
That's hard to test because I think they got excited about a new feature.
We're in a whiteboard meeting at Hopscotch, a New York startup founded by women in 2013. Hopscotch has a popular app that makes programming visual and easy for kids. That means user testing sessions are lively.
Oh, yeah, set invisibility.
Nice. Ooh, try that.
Where is it when we send...
With 2 million downloads and counting, Hopscotch has enough of those young users to merit attention of investors. Jocelyn Levitt is co-founder and CEO.
We raised 1.2 initially, and then we raised more afterwards, so we're now at about 3 million.
Levitt says there are great things about starting a company with a woman, but when it comes to raising money from investors...
I wish that we weren't. I wish that we were two guys building it, just because it just seems like everybody's more willing to jump on board.
Levitt gives us a window into how female founders talk to each other about the perils of raising money.
Sometimes women will be like, I should wear a wedding ring to make sure that this investor doesn't hit on me, versus I should not wear a wedding ring because I don't want to have to deal with questions about whether or not I'm going to be having kids anytime soon.
She fiddles with her own band as she talks. Levitt wore it when pitching. She shows me how she even sits differently in those meetings.
The way I'm sitting right now, you know, instead of crossing your legs, which I sometimes do because I'm cold, you sort of sit with your legs sitting apart and you put your elbow on the table as opposed to, you know, sitting there like hunched over and small.
There was this one rejection where an investor questioned whether the team could meet technical challenges.
We didn't know, but it felt a little bit like if we'd been guys, maybe we wouldn't have gotten that kind of feedback.
No one is saying all venture capitalists are sexist. They want to back people who make them rich. but like all of us, they can fall victim to unconscious biases. Think of a startup founder. For many, what comes to mind is the Facebook guy, the Google guys, but typically guys. Elizabeth Webb teaches a decision-making class at Columbia Business School.
If we see someone who looks like Mark Zuckerberg, let's say, we may think they're more likely to be successful because they fit in with that idea of an entrepreneur based on what we see in the media. So all of that kind of works together at a very unconscious level to inform our judgments and our evaluations.
In the end, we all need to accept our tendency to have these biases.
People often just think, well, I'm not that type of person. Other people fall victim to this, but I don't.
But that's just not true. Like other issues, the first step is admitting you have a problem. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with this very quick little story. When we did the show from Aspen, Colorado, the Ideas Festival up there back in June, I stopped at the local Starbucks for breakfast one morning and sitting there having a cup of coffee, maybe it was tea, I don't really know, noodling around on his iPad was none other than Tim Cook. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, maybe the most valuable company in the world, just sitting there all by his lonesome. Told you that so I could tell you this. I saw on the website Patently Apple today that according to filings with the SEC, Apple spent $699,133 on security for its chief executive last year. I guess they figured Aspen's really safe or something. I will tell you, we pitched him to get him to come on the show. We're still waiting for that callback. For the record, Mr. Cook, we would take an email, too. I'm sure you could figure out what my email address is. Not so hard. Just drop us a line. I'll come to you, even. You let me know. All right, the Dow off 46 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 12, also 0.25%. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, almost 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Sitar Nieves is the senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will be back here on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. And oh, yeah. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.